It's my first time at Perimeter, so I want to thank Gifre for the invitation. So I'm going to talk about a work that I finished recently together with Germán Sierra in Madrid and a PhD student also at the IFT, Manuel Campos. So, okay, so this, everybody in this room knows that tensor network techniques have been very successful as a variational answer for finding ground state and low-lying excitations. And there are different types of networks, NPS, PEPs, MERA. Well, some of them go back to Gifre. Also, real space, they are useful as tensor real space renormalization group technique. Here there are also several methods. And the main ingredient of all this technique is to exploit the entanglement properties that are expected from the states we want to reproduce. So this technique has been mostly applied to spin systems. And it's, of course, very interesting to try to apply them to quantum field theories. And that's the subject of the work I'm going to present. Of course, there is quite some work already in this direction. There has been application of these techniques to lattice gauge theories. And there is also an effort to get continuous versions of tensor networks. Also, some of the work goes back to this institute. So our approach is trying to get an adapted TRG protocol to evaluate quantum field theory path integrals. So our idea is to revisit quantum field theory with the focus put on entanglement and in particular to understand renormalization group flow from this point of view. So somehow our approach is a field theory's approach to tensor network. So we will start in this work. We just study the simplest system that is a free boson in two dimensions. This is not only the simplest system to study, but also it should be a starting point for try to implement a perturbation theory analysis in real space. So that's also part of our motivation. So we search for a method that is computationally efficient. So we will discretize space-time, put it on a, we will work on a lattice. But our main ingredient is that our link variables, they are always going to be fields. We will not discretize them. So at each of these lattice vertices will leave a field that can take values in R without any restriction. So, and the object we will want to evaluate is the Euclidean partition function that for the discretized system is here. Ax and a tau are the lattice spacings. So in the first place, in the original lattice, this one, the field variables, they live at the vertices. So we find convenient to change to a vertex model in which the field variables, they live on the links and the interaction takes place on the lattice vertices. Here, this represent the interaction vertices for this formulation, and this will be in the new vertex model. So, that's the change between the original lattice that is vertically oriented here in dotted lines and the new tilted lattice where the weight we will take from now on the lattice spacing to be equal in both directions and to just be equal to one. And the weights for these vertex formulations, they are very simple. They are just this. So, when we want to do a real space evaluation of the partition function, we want to block several of the lattice vertices and convert them into a single one. In this process, the dimension of the Hilbert space in each of the links is increased for discrete variables. If the dimension is chi, the dimension after this blocking will be chi squared. So in this process, space-time variables or degrees of freedom are traced by link variables. So if this process goes on, it's clear that the link variables, they grow exponentially, so a truncation is necessary. So there are several schemes to achieve that, But we will follow the simplest one, that is tensor network renormalization, tensor renormalization group. And this this method is based in applying a singular value decomposition to the lattice vertices. So first we group the legs in two sets that we will call from now on left and right. And the singular value decomposition is like an Smith decomposition between these two sets of variables. And the idea is then to look at the singular values of this decomposition and to truncate the smallest one, as you all know probably much better than me. And then in this process, in the first iteration, so we obtain a lattice that changes 45 degrees the orientation with respect to the first one. And so after two iterations, we recover a lattice with the same orientation. This is a particular feature of the tensor renormalization group in this implementation that is the simplest version. So we want to apply or implement that these ideas in our quantum field theory. So these are our initial weights. I write them again. So we can have an arbitrary mass. So in the first place, we want to consider a generalization of this situation. We want to consider a generic Gaussian weight where in each link, they leave several field variables. Chi fields. And this will be the most general Gaussian weight for this this situation. I have grouped the fields in left and right. So left contains the one and the two, and right the three and four. These matrices, AR, IR, and B, they are real matrices, and rho is some normalization constant that will come out of the calculation. So now we search for a singular value decomposition type decomposition in which the vertex is pulled apart or open in two sides. And our main requirement to implement that will be that the variables that appear in the new link, they also have the interpretations of fields. And our other requirement will be that the weights we obtain after each TRG iteration are always Gaussian. So the way we are going to proceed is to work at the level of the Gaussian exponent, of the exponent of our Gaussian weights. And this is going to allow us to work directly with finite matrices instead of with our continuous fields. So this implies an enormous simplification. So in order to achieve a singular value decomposition of the type I want presented of this vertex, this term that connects the left and the right field is the one that that a priori makes problematic this factorization. So this problem can be overcome by considering the singular value decomposition of this matrix B connecting left and right side and applying the simple rules of Gaussian integration. So here I brought the singular value decomposition, the generic singular value of the decomposition of this matrix B, and this D will be a diagonal matrix, but we consider only the positive entries. If they are zero entries, they are not considered, they are truncated. So the dimension of this matrix is the rank of the matrix V. So now we can convert, once using this decomposition, we can convert this interaction term or link between left and right side into a perfect square. And the perfect square can be obtained out of the integration of chi auxiliary fields that I will call pi here, using this this is just a simple Gaussian integration. So in order to complete here a Pfeffer square, these terms that depend only on left or right fields, they have to be modified in this way. And this is the decomposition we achieve of the original weights. Hmm? So this W hat here has the decomposition of an ordinary singular value. This will be the unitary matrix, and this X will be like the singular value matrix. But this decomposition here deviates from an ordinary SVD because of these additional factors that are diagonal in the left and the right fields. So this is what we call Gaussian SVD. That is a modified way or an adapted way to do the singular value decomposition, having always variables that have the interpretation of fields. Mm-hmm. So using this GSVD, we can proceed to implement the tensor renormalization group procedure. So we will start this tilted lattice will be, for example, the initial lattice. Then after introducing, doing this singular value decomposition, as I have explained, we will obtain a lattice that now is vertically oriented, and the link fields, they are these auxiliary fields I was introducing before, the pi fields, and then doing another another more cycle, we will get back to a lattice that is oriented, is tilted as the original ones, and the fields phi, they are of the same nature as the initial ones. So again, as with each TRG iteration, the lattice orientations changes 45 degrees. So we will call an RG cycle to two TRG iterations that returns to the same type of lattice. And we will call the bond dimension chi n, I mean this will, this index n correspond to the R, it will label the RG iteration in which we are, and chi will be the number of fields per link. This phi here can refer to both these two types of fields. Now, B is a 2chi times 2chi matrix, so we will expect that the number of singular values of this matrix is always 2chi, and this will imply that the link variables, they double at each of these steps. But this is actually not the case. The bond dimension doubles every complete RG cycle. This is not a particular feature of our implementation. This is just a feature of the TRG. So, and this can be sort of graphically seen here because the fields, they are here in this link, they run on this link, they come from these two legs here. So it doubles the bond dimension every complete RG cycle. Now, in the initial lattice, the bond dimension is one. It can be seen that in the first step, the bond dimension doubles because the rank of the of this interacting matrix B in the first lattice, this is just the identity and the rank is two. So this is a generic step that is the first important difference between the phi lattice and the pi lattices. So in the transition from a phi to a pi lattice, the bond dimension doubles, while in the transition from a pi lattice to a phi lattice, the chi dimension remains the constant. Mm-hmm. So that's going to play a role in the following. So as I said, without introducing truncation, the bond dimension will increase exponentially. So we have to introduce a truncation in order that we can numerically evaluate the partition function. So following with the philosophy I have presented, our requirement will be that the truncation acts on the number of fields, such that always our link variables, they are going to be fields. So I recall again the our adapted singular value decomposition. Now the matrix, the singular value of the matrix B, it can be decomposed in this way, in which this matrix D1 contains a set we have chosen some particular threshold. We have here the D1 contains the largest singular values, and this D2, the smaller singular values. So what we want to do now is to eliminate the fields associated to the smaller singular values. So as you see here, this, singular value matrix S has the form of an approximation to a delta function. So when this D is very small, as I have written here just for a single variable to simplify, this quantity can be substituted by a delta function. So the way to eliminate the pi field, the fields we they are associated to very small singular values, will be to substitute the original S by this form. And now I have to mention that this choice is not unique, because our whole structure is not an ordinary singular value decomposition. So there is some ambiguity implied in how we do the truncation. So this implies that we are modifying this D matrix. And since the D appear here, we could think in also modifying the GL and GR factors. But the easiest ways to implement is to only modify this W hat part and let and untouch these two factors. Including that modification or not doesn't change very much the numerical performance, and we find this the simplest way to do it. So that's how we will do. We just will truncate by changing this singular value matrix in this way. So now one can wonder, how efficient is this truncation? What is the error that is introduced? So if this is the optimal way of doing it or not. So unfortunately, an analysis that for the ordinary SVD cannot be done, but still we can analyze what is the difference between the SAT weights and the truncated weights. So this this is the difference here, and this W, this delta W hat is written here. So what we see, an important thing is that since if we don't introduce any cutoff for the fields, the difference, this factor here, can be arbitrarily different from zero, because even if this D is very small, if the fields tend to infinity, this factor here can be very large, can diverge. So just substituting the smaller singular values by a delta function will not be justified unless we have this by the presence of this matrix, this diagonal matrix, GL and this GR. So I have written here a simpler example to appreciate this point. So this will be like a toy model of our Gaussian weights. And this beta here is analogous to the B matrix that links the left and the right fields that here are just represented by these X and Y variables. So this will be this is the decomposition I have presented before using just the simple rules of Gaussian integration. So as I have, if this beta is very small, the approximation will be to substitute all this factor by one. And the error we commit is proportional to this. So again, we see that when this difference is very large, the error will be very large. But thanks to these additional factors, precisely what they do is that they truncate the large field values. So the error actually committed, it doesn't depend only on beta, but it goes, the leading error is proportional to beta divided by alpha. So in this singular value decomposition, it's very important. I mean, it's not really a singular value in decomposition because of these additional factors, but they are very important in order to justify the truncation. Mm-hmm. So we will call this procedure the Gaussian tensor renormalization group. Mm-hmm. So to analyze exactly how much is the error, this is complicated in this case, But what we will see, I mean, the good results we get in the following will indicate that really these matrices, GL and GR, they are really playing properly the role of regulators in the large field values. So, okay, so having introduced already what will be our procedure, so we go to the evaluation of the partition function. Of course, our system is extremely simple, it's a free theory, and using momentum modes, the partition function can be analyzed, can be obtained exactly, and has this expression here. So this will be our benchmark to compare with the numerical results. So we have here is they are plot our results for a very big lattice where this is the number of sides of the original lattice, L1 times L2. So here both, they are both equal, so it's an square lattice and has 2 to the 30 sides. Or, has this, this number of entries. So what we plot here, this is the relative error in the free energy per side, which is written here. So in this here, the numerical evaluation is done by imposing a maximal bond dimension, and these are the results for different bond dimension as a function of the scalar mass. So we see here that we get a quite good precision because for like maximal bond dimension of 32 fields per link, the relative error is below 10 to the minus 6. This will be this line. And for chi-max equal 64, we get an average precision of 10 to the minus 8. So as you see, as we increase the number of fields, the results, they start having some noise. This is because we are just using Mathematica with the standard settings. And when we go to these precisions, they get in conflict with the precision of the of Mathematica. So the results are, they have quite some noise. And what I have plotted here is the average result, the dotted lines, they are average results over small intervals of masses. But the average results, they get a precision 10 to the minus 8, which is pretty good. The the way of evaluating it is quite simple. It runs very fast. And also importantly, we get very good results, not only for the massive case. Here the mass is measured in lattice units. So one is a max of the same scale of the lattice spacing. These are small masses. And we see that the results, they are very stable and quite good. So in order to understand why this is like that, so I give here some details on the truncation. So as I have said, the the bond dimension increases when going to a phi lattice to a pi lattice. It doubles. So truncation is naturally introduced in the step that goes from a phi lattice to a pi lattice. So it's important then to analyze how the singular values of the matrix V for the phi lattice behaves. So I have plotted here an example. It's the matrix V after 3 RG cycles. The bond dimension in this case is 8, no truncation has been applied. So what we see here is that the singular values, they are very strongly decreasing. And they are not only strongly decreasing for large masses, they are also strongly decreasing for very small masses. And this is a general pattern. It happens after any number of RG cycles. And this is what makes truncation efficient and what it makes also that we can get good results for small masses. So we could have thought, in the beginning, I thought that the singular values, they will be exponentially decreasing for the massive case, and they will drop only as a power law for the for very small masses, but that's not the case. The singular values, they also decrease exponentially for very small masses. And this is what makes this procedure that has very good convergence. So as you see here, after few iterations, the singular values, they are very small. So also it appears an additional problem that is if we choose to have very small, but very large bond dimension before the truncation, before we achieve this large bond dimension, the singular values will be extremely small. So we cannot handle numerics with these very small values. We have to discard singular values smaller than a certain cutoff. So we have chosen as a cutoff 10 to the minus 11. This depends on the numerical precision of the methods for the tools Mathematica we are using. That was an optimal value. This parameter will be important when we consider very large bond, maximal bond dimension. So here I have written the relative error in the free energy per site obtained for a mass, for a very small mass, 10 to the minus 6, as a function of the bond dimension. So this curve here has two well different parts, this first part and this other part. And they correspond precisely to the way to the moment in which this parameter epsilon starts playing a role. This is a sort of technical detail, but since it has a strong influence in the efficiency of the method, so I presented it. So when the maximal bond dimension gets over 22, this epsilon parameter starts to play a role. So for smaller dimensions, the truncation is introduced when the number of fields achieves the chi-max we wish. So here we have considered chi-max equal 20, so it increases, it doubles at every step until it reaches the maximal one. So, but when chi-max is bigger than 22, this chi truncates the singular values before we achieve the maximal bond dimension. So here I have put the series for the chi max equal 64. So we see that at 22, the truncation is already triggered. So since in the step from phi to pi, the bond dimension doesn't double, it less than doubles. So it turns out that also now in the step from a pi to a phi, the bond dimension also increases. So we get sort of a stepwise increase up to the maximal bond dimension. So that will not be very important in principle a priori, but what we see is that this new way, this way of doing the truncation improves the precision at a lower computational cost, because this part here falls as a power law that is typical of the TRG protocols. But here we get a strong improvement in the precision for the same computational cost. So that's, I think it's an interesting remark from the numerical, from the numerical point of view. So given that our method allows to address the limit of very small masses, we can really try to see what is the performance of our method in the massless limit, and in particular, what is the estimation for the central charge of really the massless limit we get out of this method. So this will be the partition function we have to, this is, so in order to compare our results with the, we need to have a benchmark, so we need to evaluate the exact partition function in the massless limit. So maybe this is something known, but we haven't found this result in the literature, how this the partition function in the lattice system is linked and how the central extension appears in this expression. So maybe it's known, but we didn't know. So we have presented also in the paper how to do that. So using this this formula, it can be this, here there is a double product. So using this formula, we can perform one of the products, and then what the one obtains is this expression where these bees, they have this particular form. And the important thing is that in the limit, that L1 and L2 are very big, what we obtain here can be approximate, this product productory can be approximate, yes, by this expression, and this other one here by this infinite product. So what we see emerging here is the conformal field theory partition function. So the conformal field theory partition function for a free boson has this expression. Tau is the modular parameter. And the partition function has this expression here. So what we see that, I mean, using the previous developments, it turns out that the exact partition function relates with the conformal field theory partition function in this way, when L1 and L2 are very big. This F infinity will be the result for the free energy in the limit when L1 and L2 are very big. The modular parameter is just this expression here. So now it's easy to see that the first, the leading finite set effects, they are linked to the conformal field theory partition function. And since, of course, we know the relation between the conformal field theory partition function and the central extension, we can get, we get from this expression this, this result. And from here, comparing this with our numerical evaluation, we can get an estimation for the central charge. So actually, the thing I have plotted here is not the central charge, it's just this, this summatory that for the case we analyze in which L1 and L2 are equal, this quantity just adds up to this value. So what I have plotted here is the minus this quantity. And you see that, and this is for a lattice with 2 to the 4, L being 2 to the 4, 2 to the 5, 6, and 7. So what we see is that the value of this quantity converges toward the expected value. The results, they become increasingly noisy because the, when we increase the dimension of the lattice, also the finite size corrections, they are smaller. But if we take the average, so we obtain for a lattice with 2 to the 6, we obtain a precision in the evaluation of the central charge of 10 to the minus 5. And for 2 to the 7, in this case, the results, they have a more numerical noise or spread. But if one considers the average, the precision is 10 to the minus 6. So this is, well, I guess this is pretty good. So this is the part of the numerical results. Now I'm going to present the renormalization group implementation that we get from this real space approach. So the renormalization group flow in a free boson theory is very trivial. So if the mass is zero, it's a fixed point. If the mass is not zero, so the mass just runs with its bare dimension. And we can estimate the number of RG iterations that are necessary for the mass becoming one in lattice units, which is this this number here. Now, when the number of RG cycles is bigger, is similar or bigger that is n of m, we will expect that correlations are confined to a single plaquette. So this could be, correspond to a trivial structure, but more in general, it can also be represented by a corner double line structure that is represented here. So actually the links, they are only cover a single plaquette. So it's a well-known fact of that the TRG is not able to eliminate the ultra-local entanglement represented by this corner double line structure. And this is because when we attempt to do a singular value decomposition of this type of a structure. There is no link between these two sites, but this one here that actually belongs to a single plaquette can be this bond between these two legs is in general strong. And when we perform the singular value decomposition, there are singular values that are large that are associated to this line here. So actually, when it's easy to see that when performing the TRG, what one obtains, and if one starts with a corner double line structure, is one obtains again a corner double line structure. So the CDL is an infrared fixed point of the tensor renormalization group. So we will expect that the same happens for our GTRG. And this is indeed what happens. So there is a first test on the emergence of this CDL structure that is very easy and very graphic, and is the one that we will use. So when we perform here the singular value decomposition, we see that, well, in general, in the corner double line structure, the Hilbert space per link decomposes as the tensor product of two sets which do not interact among themselves. So what we will expect is that the singular values of B should come in pairs, one associated to this line and the other associated to this other line. So that's the thing we will check. So if we look to the, and here is going to come also the other important difference between the phi and the pi lattices. So in the phi lattices, I said that the singular values, they are strongly decreasing, but not only that they have a strong tendency to form equal value pairs. So actually here you can see that this line and this line, they contain each of them two singular values. Here you see that there is a little split, here a little bit more. So after just three RG cycles, essentially six of the singular values, they have already paired up. But this is, however, not the case for the pi lattice. This is the distribution of the singular values for a pi lattice also after three RG cycles. So what we observe here are the distinctive characteristics of this, the singular values of the matrix B in the pi lattices, is that the larger singular value is essentially proportional to the inverse of the mass square, and the rest, they are not too small. They actually, their values, they are above 0.1. And they tend to fill, as the number of singular values increases, they tend to fill the gap between 0.1 and the largest singular value, and they do not pair. So once truncation is introduced, this picture changes a bit, and what happens, here I have plotted the renormalization group flow for the singular values of pi lattice for mass equal to 10 to the minus 5 and chi max equal 24. So what happens is that the number of RG iteration increases, the gap between the largest singular value, the one that is proportional to one of m squared, and the second singular value, it tends to close up. So the smaller is m, the largest is the initial gap, and the more RG cycles are needed. So this is, in this way, this is how we see that we obtain the usual RG flow result. And we obtain, in this case, we obtain that the CDL structure is compatible with a number of RG cycles of around 19. And if we compare that with the prediction of the just the scaling argument, in this case, we obtain that n, the number of RG cycles when the mass becomes over the one in lattice units, is 16, 17. So we need like a couple more iterations to really establish a complete CDL structure. So we see that the result is totally consistent with the prediction of the scaling argument. And also we see how it happens that the smaller the mass, the larger number of iteration. And it's because this gap between the larger singular value and the rest increases. So here I have plotted the flow of the singular values for a fixed mass. but the same picture should be obtained in, if we keep fixed the number of singular values and we vary the scalar mass. So this is this other plot. So what we see is that the singular values that perfectly pair up to a certain threshold value of the mass. In this case, they pair up to m of the order 0.03. If we write this quantity in lattice units, we obtain 8. So again, we see the same result, that the CDL doesn't set up before a scale larger than the correlation less, that that is 1 over n. So what I have presented before, this simple criterion of looking at the pairing between the singular values of the matrix B, is not enough to ensure that the whole CDL structure is realized. What we need, let's look at the matrix B, that the submatrix of the of B that I call B hat, that connects fields on opposite links. So in a CDL structure, this B hat will be should be equal to zero. So now, in order to quantify how far we are from the CDL structure, we have defined this quantity that is the norm of B, normalized by the maximal bond dimension and the largest singular value. So we have shown, I will not present it here, but we saw in the paper that the vanishing of P on two successive TRG iterations, so along a complete RG cycle, is a sufficient condition for the establishment of a complete CDL structure that then is maintained along the next RG iterations that we can perform. So for this same example I have plotted before, m equal 10 to the minus 5 and maximal bond dimension of 22. This is just this very graphic criterion that that the singular values should pair up. And here is the plot of this this quantity. And you see that precisely on the same when the first two singular values they joined, this quantity has a very abrupt fall. And that shows that the complete CDL structure is realized, both for the, this happens for the pi and for the phi lattices. So finally, we have plotted also the number of renormalization group cycles to reach a CDL infrared fixed point for different masses. And here is plotted for two different maximal bond dimensions, 8 and 64. The dotted line is the theoretical scaling argument, and we have considered that the CDL structure is realized when this quantity, this indicator, is smaller than 10 to the minus 7. So the first thing we see is that similar results are obtained for large and small bond dimensions, and that both of them, they are consistent with the scaling argument. So this suggests that some long-distance information is kept for any maximal, for any bond dimension, which maybe is a remarkable, also a remarkable fact. And a possible reason, I'm not sure if this is the real reason, but this, I think it's interesting to do this remark, is that contrary to a usual truncation, in our way of truncating, always arbitrarily small singular values are kept. And this is because, so we have this structure and we want to truncate fields, not just only small singular values, but fields. So we truncate fields that they always contribute small, with small singular values. But even the fields we obtain in the limit of large field values, they also will have associated very small singular values. So actually, because we are acting on fields and keeping always complete fields, we are always keeping an infinite number of singular values and arbitrarily small singular values. So maybe this is behind the fact that we always get a reasonable, for any one dimension, we get a reasonable estimation of the correlation length. So in the last quarter of an hour,
Sorry, what was that? That was the plot of the correlation length?
Well, I mean, no, it's not, essentially it's not a correlation length. It's when the CDL structure is realized. But I guess this is linked. The correlation length will be related to the number of cycles necessary to achieve.
But the tests that you've presented that show that the method is providing accurate results is the one, the test that you presented was the comparison of the exact Hamiltonian function with the numerical one, right?
Yes, yes, but here in this part, I'm not doing this comparison. I'm just looking when the CDL structure is established. So.
But is having a CDL structure established a sign of proper performance of the algorithm, or?
I will think so. Yes, I mean because you want that when you are at the scales that are larger than the mass, that I mean the essentially the system that has become trivial. So this is what you expect from the usual renormalization group. So this should be implemented here. I mean, it should happen. The only thing that in this TRG protocol, it will not achieve a real infrared trivial fixed point as it happens with the tensor network renormalization. What emerges here is a CDL structure, but still is representing the same infrared fixed point. So it should happen that this establishes at a number of iterations.
I agree that you would expect that structure, but have you been able to test, to probe it, to see whether it has the right correlations?
Well, I guess the CDL always has trivial correlations. I mean, anything that is, no, we haven't done a calculation of correlators, but okay, maybe it's too much to say, but I will expect that.
But you could insert.
Yes, yes, I know. I mean, there are many continuation of this analysis, but we haven't done it yet, but of course we have it in mind. But I will expect that once the CDL structure is established, the correlations, they are trivial. So this is now a different subject that is what we are working right now is to look at the integrability properties of the bosonic of the lattice of the boson the statistical system that we get after discretization. So of course free bosons, they are integrable, even if they have mass or they don't have mass. The conserved charges, they are the occupation numbers. But these are things that, especially in the massive case, that maybe you could think that they are global quantities because they are momentum modes, and they are not so easy to see at the local level. And we are just looking here at the statistical weights, at the lattice weights. So that was our motivation, to see if we see the integrability structure at the level, at the local level. Mm-hmm. So these are the, here we will work at the level of the weights of the initial lattice. That is what I have written here again. So the first thing we need in order to test integrability is to introduce a spectral parameter. So a natural spectral parameter here is just all the calculations before, they are done with the lattice spacing being equal to each other, and in particular equal to one. So a natural parameter that that appears from this construction is letting the quotient between the lattice spacing in the two directions to be a generic parameter that I call C. Letting for this relation, the weights this the original wave, they have this expression here. Two of the fields, they come with C. Two of the fields, they come with 1 over C. And here, at, I allow for a mass parameter that may depend on C. So in order to check integrability, so we construct the transfer matrix in this way. And we have to check if the matrices, the transfer matrices, they commute for arbitrary values of these spectral parameters. So a first check that you will expect is that the transfer matrix, it trivializes when the spectral parameter tends to zero or tends to a particular value. Here it's very easy that this happens when C tends to zero. With C tends to zero, if we assume that we will show later that this parameter M of C also tends to zero, then it's immediate to see that the transfer matrix gets reduced to the shift operator. This is because, let me go back. So these contributions, all of them, they will vanish, and this will tend to infinity, and then will focus, I mean, will oblige phi 1 and phi 3 to be equal, and phi 4 and phi 1 to be equal. And this, what this implies is this, that in the limit C equal to 0, the transfer matrix is reduced to the shift operator. So this looks a reasonable test for C to be a good spectral parameter. So now we check the Jan-Buster equation. So we have the three vertices. Each of them has a different spectral parameter. And again, since our weights are Gaussian, the check of the Jan-Buster equation can be done just at the level of the exponent. So here it's very easy to see that if you just turn this set like 180 degrees, these two structures are the same with x and y exchange, and provided that the weight, they have a 180 degrees rotation symmetry, which they do. So the only thing we have to, so Jan-Buster will be fulfilled if this mx is equal to my and this matrix M is symmetric. So this is precisely the test we have done. And in the massless case, we obtain that the Jan-Buster is satisfied if the three parameters, C parameters, they satisfy this relation, which can be uniformized introducing these parameters U and B. And as expected for Jan-Buster, the C2 has the same expression, but it depends. The spectral parameter associated to C2 is U plus B. So that's as expected. When we do to the massive case, we obtain here, essentially it comes out quite easily, but in the massive case it's quite non-trivial that Jan-Buster is satisfied, and actually is satisfied just by a very natural elliptic deformation of these formulas. So instead of cotangent, here we have cosinus, the elliptic cosine, the elliptic sine, and this additional function dn. So we see there is a smooth limit between the massive case that is elliptic and the massless case that is the trigonometric limit. And the mass parameters, of course, in order to fulfill Jan-Buster, this doesn't only fix this a relation between C1, C2, and C3, but also imposes that the mass parameter depends on C in this way. And now so we see that for K, being K the usual elliptic parameter, smaller than 0, we get positive masses. Interestingly, in principle, it allows also for negative mass square. But if we consider K smaller than 0, we get a positive mass. That is the case we will expect. And also, it's very easy to see that indeed we get that M square tends to 0 when these CIs, they go to 0. So then certainly the transfer matrix in the limit C equal to 0 trivializes and reduces to this shift operation. So, so let me present what we obtained recently. So, of course, we are going to get the, just the usual results. Everybody knows for the free case, but we want to reobtain the eigenstates using this this formalism. So if we have a if this phi will be an eigenstate, it should satisfy this this relation where this is a the transfer matrix, which I have presented before, this can be evaluated exactly in this case. So it has, of course, a Gaussian, we get also a Gaussian expression. And this matrix M of C, it can be evaluated exactly and has a simple expression. And of course, this quantity could always sort of diagonalize it. But the fact, the non-trivial fact of integrability is that the wave functions that one obtains from this equation, they are independent of C. And only the eigenvalue will encode the C dependence. Mm-hmm. So that's equivalent actually to Jenbuster. So what happens in this case is that this matrix M is actually built out of just the identity X and X to the minus one, with X is the sieve matrix in field space. So this determines, as it should be expected, that the eigenstates, they are expressed in terms of momentum modes. So, and of course we are recovering here the usual results for the free theory, but the point is that the integrability structure, we have obtained it in real space. So this means that they are some local charges that are associated to this integrability structure. What we could expect, we know that the conserved charges are the momentum modes, but there must be some way of combining them that translate into conserved local charges. So that's the non-trivial part of this analysis. So just by solving this equation, it can be seen that we obtain the wave function of the ground state, which has this expression with this omega k. They are the energy associated to the different momentum modes. In the lattice, this will this instead of being just p squared, it has this expression. And the excited state, they can be constructed out of multiplying this expression by Hermite polynomials of this x tilde k. So we recover from this condition, or from this diagonalization or eigenstate condition on the transfer matrix, the spectrum of the free boson theory. And we can also analyze now the conserved charges, because this lambda of C, they are easy to obtain. And for the ground state, we obtain this expression with this A of C is very much related to the mass. Well, has this expression here, and it's easy to see that it tends to 1 over C when C goes to 0. So expanding this quantity in powers of C, one obtains that the conserved charges obtained for the different powers of C, they are related to the summation in K of the frequencies to some power. Not very surprising, probably. And for the excited state, the conserved charges that one obtains is the is a product, has a product structure. This is the part that comes from the ground state, and they are some contribution associated to the different excitations, so momentum excitations that we can have. And this rises to nk, where nk are the occupation numbers. So with this formalism, based just on the transfer matrix, the occupation numbers, they appear naturally. And this lambda of k, they have this expression, also it's not too complicated, where this part here, this part together with the ground state will make that, well, this still we have to finish performing this analysis, but I think once having that, it's pretty clear that this generalized to the combination AK plus 1/2 of these powers of the frequencies. Why there is this 1/2 relative between the contribution from NK and 1/2 is because here it appears at 2 and here there is just linear. And then there is an additional contribution from this part, which I don't totally understand yet, but it goes with N, the occupation numbers times momentum that is 2 pi k over m. The particularity is that this part here does not depend on the mass. All the mass dependence is on this on the frequencies here. So now this is the analysis in momentum space. And the interesting thing that still we haven't finished is to see really what is the expression of the conserved charges in the local conserved charges associated to this structure. So with this, I finish the seminar. So for the first part, I have presented an adapted tensor renormalization group protocol to apply to quantum field theories, which the main ingredient was that the lattice variables, they are always fields. We have seen that it's numerically efficient, even in the massless case, and it gives us a nice picture of the renormalization group flow, just doing the analysis in real space. And then I think also another use of this protocol is that it can serve as a starting point for a perturbation theory expansion. Mm-hmm. And then in the second part, I have talked about the integrability in the bosonic lattice. Here, obvious things to do is that obtain the local commuting charges, as I have said, and also to link in the massless case, to link the integrability structure to Virasoro. So that's all.
Can you elaborate? You said there was a certain freedom in the way, or some you had to make a choice when you were doing the truncation.
Yes.
Can you elaborate a little bit more on that? Like, what was exactly the thing that you had to choose on?
Okay.
What
yes.
The consequences are?
I think it was. It was more. So here, so this sort of singular value decomposition deviates from a real singular value decomposition in these two contributions that we have seen that are important for the truncation to be justified. So here, by doing this substitution, we are changing this matrix D. Mm-hmm. So the small singular values, we are substituting them by zero. So we see that D also appears in this diagonal matrix GL and GR. So we could accordingly also modify GL and GR. But the easiest choice is not to do it, just to act on the link between the left and the right fields. So that's, the ambiguity is related to that. We check a bit, didn't have a very strong influence, and this choice was slightly better. But the thing is that we cannot do such a nice analysis as you can do with a regular singular value decomposition in which you can show that it's optimal, at least for taking the norm only on the vertex. So this we cannot do, and I think it will be good to do a further analysis of this. But this is more cumbersome because it doesn't depend only on the singular values of B, it depends also on the singular values of the eigenvalues of this matrix GL and GR, well, in the exponent. So the analysis is a bit more complicated. But I think it's important to have into account that the whole structure is necessary for being able to truncate at the level of the exponent.
Okay.